Genesis chapter 20, starting in verse 1 this evening. So we're in part 22 of our study of Genesis. Genesis chapter 20 is kind of an interesting chapter. And it's, sort of a bit of a parenthetical chapter, I suppose. One that is a real change of pace after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah in the last chapter and all the happenings there, and then we dealt with that, and then suddenly we really changed gears, and it really speaks to sort of the ebb and flow of our lives of faith, and Abraham was no different. And for that matter, his wife Sarah was no different in her life. And you know, we as we go through life, our faith waxes and wanes, and you know, sometimes we're ready to take on anything, and other times we sort of wonder, if we have the faith to get out of bed in the morning. And really, you see in this chapter that Abraham was no different. I mean, here's a man who really stood with God and looked down on Sodom not a chapter or so ago, and God, you know, let him in on his plans, and he talked with God, and he conversed with God, and bargained with God, and now we see just the opposite in Abraham. So it doesn't seem like it took really all that long. And we find Abraham and Sarah journeying in a pagan land. We find out in the next chapter, chapter 21, the last verse, that's the land of the Philistines. You run into the Philistines, of course, they're later on in the Bible, David slew Goliath. He was one of the Philistines, so they weren't always friends of the Israelites. But meanwhile, Abraham, verse 1, journeyed from thence toward the south country and dwelled between Kadesh and Shur and sojourned in Gerar. And something that seems very familiar, when he was in Egypt, when he and Sarah went to Egypt because of the drought, you see another instance of what happened at that time. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. So the same thing that happened when Abraham and Sarah were in Egypt, and Pharaoh looked at Sarah and said, you know, she's really cute, and they took Sarah to Pharaoh. Well, the same occurrence is happening again. Now, one thing that I know it was Mike that pointed out to me, not recently, but some time ago, was, you know, you have to think about this. Here's Abimelech, the king of one of the cities in the land of the Philistines, and he looks at a woman and says, "Boy, I sure do think she's cute," and he takes her for his own. Well, two things about that really you need to realize. First of all, she's pregnant at this time. Now, I realize that a lot of pregnant women get a glow about them. You know, when they get pregnant, they just, I don't know what it is, they just glow. And, even average looking women, really become attractive for some reason. Their face just glows and they just have this air about them. But she's pregnant. And so, this is not the hot babe with the two-piece bathing suit that you're going after here. And the other thing that you have to keep in mind, as Mike pointed out some time ago to me, it's been a year or more that you pointed this out to me, but it came to mind. Sarah's 90 years old. Sarah is 90 years old. And at 90, she had to have been a pretty good-looking woman for the king of one of the territories of the Philistines to look at her and say, you know what, she looks pretty good. I want her as my own. Because that's exactly what happened. So, there's times when Sarah says, I'm old and I'm past the time of childbearing and my husband is too old to father a child and I'm too old to be a mother and all this. And yet, here we find Abimelech, the king, wanting Sarah. Now, is this a miraculous occurrence, brought on by God? Was she just really supernaturally attractive at this particular time? The Bible doesn't explain. But you have to realize she must have been miraculously beautiful at this point in her life. Well, no matter what it is, and Dave says, yes, she must have been a knockout. You're exactly right. A 90-year-old knockout. Kind of like Edith, who just logged on a few minutes ago. So, but God warns Abimelech not to touch Sarah. So we pick up in verse 3, God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Behold, thou art but a dead man, for the woman which thou hast taken, for she is a man's wife." But Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, "Lord, wilt thou slay also a righteous nation? Said he not unto me, she is my sister, and she," speaking of Sarah, "even she herself said, this is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and innocency of my hands have I done this." So he's saying, I haven't done a thing. They told me they're brother and sister. Both of them did. And God said unto him in a dream, "Yea, I know that thou didst this thing in the integrity of thy heart. For I also withheld thee from sinning against me. Therefore I suffered I thee not to touch her. Now therefore restore the man his wife, for he is a prophet, and he shall pray for thee, and thou shalt live. And if thou restore her not, know thou that thou shalt surely die, thou and all that are thine." So God basically says, restore Sarah to Abraham, or you're a dead man. All your, you and all your nation. God doesn't give him any choice, does he? Really. And so Abimelech takes God's advice and says that that's a pretty good indication of what I ought to do. And Abimelech, verse 8, arose early in the morning and called all his servants and told all these things in their ears, and the men were sore afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said unto him, "What hast thou done unto us? And what have I offended thee that thou hast brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? Thou hast done deeds unto me that thou that ought not to be done." So, why have you done this? Why have you lied to me? Why have you caused me to take Sarah when you're married to her? Well, that's a good question, Abraham. Why did you do this? Well, really, it was fear. It was fear of the same fear that Abraham had when he went into Egypt. If you remember, when Sarah and Abraham journeyed into Egypt because of they were looking. What's that?
It's a drought.
It was the drought. That's exactly right. Because of the drought and the famine. That was the word I was trying to think of. Because of the famine in the land, and you know, Abraham, you know, told Sarah, "Well, say that you're my sister, because if they find out you're my wife, they'll kill me, so that they can have you." Well, why would Abraham, you know, so was done in fear then, so why would Abraham this time do the same thing? Tell them he's or she's his sister instead of his wife. The same reason. It was out of fear. It was out of fear. So it was Abraham reckoned that they had no fear of God. And that's what caused him to fear. And Abimelech said unto Abraham, verse 10, "What sawest thou that thou hast done this thing? What did you see that caused you to lie to us?" And Abraham said, "Because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake. But the fact of the matter is that Abraham and Sarah were telling the truth about their relationship. And this is something we didn't know up until this point. That they were actually telling the truth about being brother and sister. And Abraham comes out and says as much. In verse 12 and 13, Abraham says, "And yet indeed she is my sister. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. And it came to pass, when God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said unto her, 'This is thy kindness which thou shalt show unto me at every place whither we shall come. Say of me, he is my brother.'" So they weren't really lying. They were brother and sister. They had the same father, but not the same mother. So here we learn something about Sarah and Abraham. They were half brother and half sister. So they were telling the truth, just not the whole truth, out of fear that Abraham had. Was one that told him the whole truth out of fear that he would be killed, because he still wasn't completely trusting God, was he? What was the promise that God had made, that he would bless those who blessed him and curse them who cursed him, and that he would be the father of a great nation, and you know, all these promises were made to Abraham, and yet he still wasn't trusting God's promise, was he? He still wasn't believing everything that God had to say. So that's really the crux of the matter. After all this time, and after all the time that is spent with God, and the conversations with God, and the reiterated promises that God makes to Abraham, he still isn't completely trusting everything that God has said to him. So, after all this is revealed, Abimelech honors Abraham with gifts, and says, "Go ahead and, you know, my land is your land. Just have whatever part you want." And Abimelech, verse 14, took sheep and oxen and men servants and women servants, gave them unto Abraham, and restored him Sarah his wife. And Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before thee, dwell where it pleaseth thee." And Sarah then is justified as a wife and sister, because Abraham is her protector from the eyes of all others, according to Abimelech. Unto Sarah, Abimelech said, "Behold, I have given thy brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, he is under thee a covering of the eyes, unto all that are with thee, and all with all other." Thus she was reproved. So she was repaid for her trouble. And so because of the repayment, Abraham prays that the house of Abimelech would be blessed. And it is. Remember the promise of God in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. I will bless them that bless thee, and curse thee that curse thee, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So Abimelech just got done blessing Abraham with all the gifts and everything else. So verse 17, Abraham prayed unto God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, and they bare children. For the Lord had fast closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. So that's the second occurrence where this happens. Now there's going to be another occurrence of the same type of event with Isaac as we go through the book of Genesis. We'll deal with that when we get to it. But this happening, this event happening, this loss of faith, oftentimes, as I've said before, we think about people like Abraham, people like Moses, people like David, and all these people in the Bible that God dealt with personally. And you think, how they must have been so much better than we are. They must have been holier or closer to God. They must have had some kind of channel to God. They must, after they talked to God, they must have walked around praying all the time. You get all kinds of ideas. And yet, here is Abraham with a lack of faith. And we find him doing the same things that he did immediately after his father, Terah, had died. And rather than stopping in the land that he was supposed to, the land of Canaan, he marches right through the land of Canaan, and because there's a drought in the land and famine going on, he says, "Well, can't stop here. We need to go to Egypt." Rather than trust God for their provision, he says, "Well, we need to go to Egypt," and continues on to Egypt where he shouldn't have been. He didn't trust God then. He's still not trusting God. And here we are, 8-9 chapters later. And we're talking about years later in the life of Abraham. Fortunately for us, the grace of God doesn't always depend upon our worthiness to receive it, as we know. If it did, we'd all have our goose cooked. So, after the failure of chapter 20 that we see here, God keeps his promise to visit Sarah, the promise that we read about in chapter 18, in verse 10, where the Lord is there and says, "Certainly I will return unto thee according to the time of life, and Sarah, thy wife, shall have a son." And that is the promise. And the time is coming up. And in Genesis chapter 21, verse 1, we find that something really strange, almost as strange as a 90-year-old woman being fawned over by a king, is occurring here. Remember, Moses wrote the book of Genesis, and there's been times before where verses are written, and you think, these strange events are just reported on in a matter-of-fact sort of way. And in Genesis 21, verse 1 and 2, here you have the birth of a child, which in and of itself is miraculous, but it's the birth of a child by a 90-year-old woman. And it's really reported on by Moses as if it was an everyday occurrence, as if it's something that we're just supposed to happen. Well, the reason, as you read it, the reason it was reported on that way, that it's recorded in the Bible that way, as if it was something that was supposed to happen, is because it is something that was supposed to happen. Because God had said that it was going to happen. As we look at verses 1 and 2, in your outline, look at what I have underlined. And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said. You see, God had already said that he was going to visit Sarah. And the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken. He said, I'm going to visit you, and you're going to conceive a child. For Sarah conceived and bare Abraham a son in his old age at the set time. That was already spoken. The Lord had said, at that time I'm going to visit you and you're going to bear a son. At the set time of which God had spoken to him. So four times in those two verses, you see that God had already spoken about Sarah, who would be 90 years old, at a particular time is going to conceive and then bear a son. And it had been spoken of time and time and time again by God. So Moses just reports the facts. It was already known that it was going to happen. It's not reported on as a big miracle, just as a, you know, this is what occurred. So Sarah has the son at 90 years old. And in the next verses, and now Abraham, you would think that with all the promise of God, that Abraham, that son would have popped out of there and Abraham would have been jumping for joy. But that is not the case. That is absolutely not the case. Remember, Abraham is a person. He's a human being. He has feelings. He can love. He can hate. He has attachments. He has emotions, just like everyone else. He has expectations. He has doubts. He has faith. He has disbelief. He knows things. He doesn't know other things. And God has said, from your loins, there's going to be a son. And from this son, there's going to be nations, and all the earth's going to be blessed, and all this. Who's there already?
Ishmael
is there already. Ishmael's there already. That's exactly right. Remember, Ishmael is there already. And Abraham loves him very much. So, at 100 years old, when we read these next verses, really Abraham seems a whole lot less enthusiastic about the birth of Isaac, about the birth of this next son. And you read the next verses, and he does what is commanded of him by God to do. He's not overjoyed. He's not thrilled. He does what is commanded by God to do. Remember also, Abraham was willing to, he already has a son, Ishmael. He was willing to subject Sarah, who was pregnant at the time to a pagan king, and it's possible that he didn't care so much about the promise of having a son. Because if you remember in chapter 17, verse 18, when God says, in Isaac will the promises be, it will be Isaac that will be the recipient of the promises. What did Abraham say? Abraham says, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee." Abraham's lobbying for Ishmael to be the recipient of the promises. He's not saying, "Oh, good, that son that's going to be born to Sarah is going to get the promises instead of Ishmael." He's no. He says, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. That's the one I want to have the promises. God, he's the son I love. God, he's the one that I pick. Lord." Yeah. So in verse 3 through 5, Abraham called the name of his son that was born unto him, whom Sarah bare to him, Isaac. That was what the name that God picked. Abraham circumcised his son Isaac, being 8 days old, as God had commanded him. And Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born unto him. There's no party. There's no jumping for joy. He's not thrilled. I mean, he just did exactly what God had told him to do. Sarah, on the other hand, seems overjoyed at the arrival. And Sarah said, "God hath made me to laugh, so that all that hear will laugh with me." And she said, "Who would have said unto Abraham that Sarah should have given children son? For I have borne him a son in his old age." Sarah, on the other hand, is thrilled to death. "I've had a son. I've given birth to a boy." Now the events that happen next are hard events. Isaac is weaned. Now, years and years ago, I say years and years ago, my youngest son wasn't weaned till he was at least 3 years old. I know you probably find that hard to believe, but he was not bottle fed, but he was not weaned till he was probably about 3 years old. That's the way it used to be. Thousands of years ago, children just nursed for a longer time. So Isaac was probably 3 or 4 years old before he was weaned. And when he finally was weaned, children, when they were finally weaned, it was customary to celebrate the event. Well, understand, there's a great difference of age between Ishmael and Isaac. If Isaac was 3 or 4, Ishmael was at that time then in his early teens. And Abraham, I'm sure, loved Ishmael very much. So, verse 8, as the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast the same day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah... Now remember the friction between Hagar and Sarah. There's no love lost there. There never was after Hagar got pregnant. Remember what Hagar did? She looked at Sarah and with sort of disgust, "I got pregnant and you can't." Remember that? So there's no love lost between Sarah and Hagar. Well, Sarah, verse 9, saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. Okay, well, Moses says she was mocking. Paul comments about what went on. And what Paul says in Galatians 4:29, you know, from mocking, you might think, well, making fun of, or maybe Ishmael was just playing and Sarah took it wrong, or whatever the case may be. But Paul makes clear what was going on between Ishmael and Isaac. In Galatians 4:29, Paul says, "But as then he that was born after the flesh persecuted him that was born after the Spirit." In other words, Ishmael was persecuting Isaac. It wasn't just mocking. It was tormenting. It was persecution. It was Big Brother really taking advantage of the little brother. And this wasn't the first time. There was persecution going on between the two. So with Ishmael tormenting Isaac, Sarah then demands from Abraham that he send Hagar and the boy away. Genesis 21:10, "Wherefore she said unto Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac." Now, Sarah's motive is not explained in the Bible, but I've been married for some time, and one thing about women is that I do know is that they can hold a grudge for a long, long time. They never forget if you do something wrong. They bring things up. You can do something wrong 20 years ago, and they'll still bring it up if they get mad at you. Probably jealousy. Sarah was probably jealous of Hagar and probably jealous of Ishmael. What's the one thing that the mother wants the father to do? Pay attention to the children. And if you have a child there that's drawing the attention of the father away from your child, if you're the mother, that's a problem. So the only way to cure that is to get rid of that problem. And that's exactly what Sarah was probably thinking. I have to get rid of this problem. Abraham's probably spending too much attention on Ishmael and probably spending too much attention on Hagar. So cast out the bond woman, get rid of this woman, and get rid of her son. And then attention would be paid to me, and most importantly, to Isaac. This really doesn't catch Sarah in a very good light. It's certainly not in character with what Peter has to say about Sarah. You know, remember we read in Hebrews about Abraham and how Abraham was had such a stalwart faith. You know, he was a man of great faith. You know, in Hebrews chapter 11, the faith chapter. You know how great Abraham's faith was. You know, and as we study through Genesis, we find all these failures of faith. Well, the author of Hebrews doesn't concern himself with the failures. He concerns himself with the successes of faith. Well, here we don't really see the best side of Sarah either. Peter, on the other hand, doesn't concern himself with those bad moments. You know, people aren't always at their best. When we're here at the church, most times we're usually at our best. I'm often glad that the people who come here don't live with me. You know, Beth does. She can tell you all about it. And I can tell you all about her. But there's no reason to. Just as Peter has no reason to talk about Sarah at her worst. So when Peter talks about Sarah, he uses her at her best as an example. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 4 through 6, he says, "But let be the hidden man of the heart in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price." Now, she at this time does not have a meek and quiet spirit, does she? Peter says, "For after this manner in the old time, the holy women also who trusted in God adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands." At this time, she's not in subjection to Abraham at all. She's fixed to tell him what to do. "Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham." This isn't the case at all. She's not obeying him. She is expecting him to obey her. "Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as ye do well, and are not afraid with any amazement." So, obviously, Peter doesn't use this example when he wrote about Sarah and her subjection to Abraham. This is not Sarah at her best. This is the other side of Sarah's character. So just as in the previous chapter we saw Abraham not at his best, here we're seeing Sarah not at her best either. We're seeing Sarah jealous, backbiting, demanding, very ungodly. We're seeing her...
She's reaping what she sowed because she's the one who told him to do it.
She is reaping exactly what she sowed because she, you're exactly right, Mike. She's the one who told Abraham to have a union with Hagar to produce a son.
I think Paul says somewhere in there, it's good not to marry, but if you marry and you marry a virgin, you will have troubles in the flesh. And I think that's just what they're saying.
Troubles in the flesh. Exactly right. Exactly right.
Yeah, when she didn't follow God, she cursed herself.
Yeah.
And that ain't a good curse to do it to yourself.
No.
But maybe she learned something from that. She
should have learned something. Whether she did or not, it's hard to say. What we do know is that Abraham loved Ishmael. There's no doubt about that. Because he was his son. No matter what we think about Ishmael, it's hard not to be prejudiced against Ishmael, because in the year 2013, we think of Ishmael and associate him as the father of the Arab nations and Muslims and this, that, and other thing. But the fact of the matter is that Abraham loved his oldest son very much and saw him as the fulfillment of the promise that God had made to him. And why not? In Genesis 12:2, God said, "I will make of thee a great nation, I will bless thee, make thy name great, thou shalt be a blessing." In Genesis 15:4, the Lord says, "Behold, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, This shall not be thine heir, but he that shall come forth out of thine own bowels shall be thine heir." Genesis 17:15, God said unto Abraham, "As for Sarai thy wife, thou shalt not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be, and I will bless her and give her a son also of her, and I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations, kings of people shall be of her." But to that, Abraham laughed. He didn't really believe it. And in Genesis 18:10, God said, "I will certainly return unto thee according to the time of life, and lo, Sarah thy wife shall have a son." And Sarah heard it in the tent door which was behind him, and Sarah started laughing. So I don't know that either of them ever really believed that. I'm not sure that either of them ever really if it ever sank in as truth, as you know, as reality, until that sun appeared. So Ishmael was flesh and blood. He was there. And Abraham saw him as the fulfillment of the promise. And now he's being forced to choose between Sarah and Hagar, a son which he has known for 12, 13 years, and a son which is just a little boy, which he doesn't really know at all. And in verse 11, the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight because of his son Ishmael. Well, absolutely. How would you have felt? Put yourself in Abraham's shoes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Abraham hadn't heard what God had said to Hagar when she cast out.
No.
About his sons.
Well, God does intervene. God sees the grieving that Abraham is going through and steps in and talks to Abraham. In the very next verse, God said unto Abraham, let it not be grievous in thy sight because of the lad and because of thy bondwoman. In all that Sarah has said unto thee, hearken unto her voice. For in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And also of the son of the bondwoman will I make a nation, because he is thy seed. But you need to realize that both the boy and Hagar are both very close to Abraham, if not loved by Abraham. They had to have been loved by Abraham. Not just the boy, but Hagar, the bondwoman also. Prior to this, throughout all the times Hagar is brought up, she is always called Sarah's handmaid. But did you notice what God just called her here? Thy bondwoman, as he's talking to Abraham. He doesn't refer to it as Sarah's bondwoman or Sarah's handmaid. It's thy bondwoman. God understood the relationship. You see, you can't have intimate relationship with another without the development of an emotional attachment. You can't produce offspring and rear the offspring and raise the offspring, you know, to 12 or 13 years old together without the emotional attachment developing. Sarah told Abraham, take Hagar as your wife. What did Sarah expect? But there would be an emotional attachment developed between Abraham was living with two families, Sarah and Hagar and Ishmael. And now Sarah is demanding that Abraham cut off and get rid of, amputate part of his in one of his families. But it would have been impossible. It would have been absolutely impossible for Hagar to remain. It would have been impossible for Hagar and Ishmael to remain because Isaac would never have been able to take his place as the recipient of the promises of God had Ishmael remained. Abraham would have never, ever let go of his hopes and dreams for Ishmael to stand before God as the recipient of the promises, as he had implored God to do before. Oh, that Ishmael may walk before thee. Because which one did he love? Did he love Isaac or did he love Ishmael? Which was his favorite? It was Ishmael. Yeah, it was the oldest, absolutely. And he would have, that would have never changed. It would have never changed. Ishmael had to leave. Sarah knew that, and most importantly, God knew that. It had to be.
Just a little bit different than the guy who was the father of Joseph, and he was his favorite because he was the last.
That's right. It was just the opposite. That's right. Well, to wrap this up, because we've looked at the casting out of the bondwoman and the casting out of Ishmael, I can think of no better time than to look at what Paul has to say in Galatians about the two. Because Isaac represents the promise of God received by faith. Even though Abraham had trouble believing, laughed when God said, Sarah will have a son. Even though Sarah had trouble believing it, and laughed when the Lord said, I will be back this time next year, and you will conceive and have a son. And really, it's hard to tell whether either of them ever believed it until Isaac popped out and said, here I am. But Isaac represents the promise that God had made. You will have a son. And the son will be the product of your loins. He represents the fulfillment of the promise by faith. Ishmael represents that which is the product of human endeavor. Because it was never the agenda of God. It was the idea conceived in the mind of people. And it was a product of human endeavor, human effort, not of faith in God. And that which is human effort is never of faith. It's never of faith. So in Galatians chapter 4, starting in verse 22, Paul says, for it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondmaid, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born after the flesh, the product of human endeavor, in other words. But he of the free woman was by promise, that which was of faith. Which things are an allegory? For these are the two covenants, the one from the Mount Sinai, which gendereth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. Remember, she came from Egypt. And answereth to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. But Jerusalem, which above is free, which is the mother of us all. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are the children of promise. But as then he that was born after the flesh persecuted him that was born after the Spirit, even so it is now. Nevertheless, what saith the Scripture? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not the children of the bondwoman, but of the free. So you see how Paul then uses the relationship of Hagar and Ishmael as contrasting to Sarah and Isaac. One, the Old Testament and the law, as opposed to the New Testament and the liberty of grace. So, having studied the two and the casting out of Hagar and Ishmael, I think it was appropriate then that we end with Paul's lesson in Galatians about those two, so that you can understand exactly what it was that he was referring to when he made that reference.